Ray Jasper is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ray Jasper to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck. Houston Vigil reporter, Dave Atwood. Tonight's featured guest, the legal team that analyzes the case on each show. They'll reveal a little-known reason for the Lone Star State's disproportionately high number of executions. The execution watch for Ray Jasper begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. It is a little after 6 o'clock on Wednesday, and they are scheduling the execution of Ray Jasper tonight. We've analyzed the case, or the lawyers have analyzed the case pretty thoroughly, and I learned that Ray Jasper was born in Europe. He is the prodigy of military personnel, and that he had no extensive record before this case happened. And that raises several issues. There will be a special discussion tonight about the Texas execution law. It'll be compared and contrasted with other states' execution law. It's one of those times when we take a little time out to try to explain to you, the listener, why Texas is so different. But Ray Jasper is awaiting execution. We have a reporter in Huntsville. Could somebody put... Somebody, hello. Can I have Gloria? This is Ray. You're on the air.
Oh, let me turn this off, okay? Well, I had just been told the Supreme Court hadn't ruled, but apparently they have, because the five reporters just went in to the Walls unit. So I assume that that means that the appeals were denied and that they're going to murder Ray Jasper.
Well, are you familiar with Ray Jasper's family situation? Is there family that is subject to be there tonight?
I don't think so. He quit having visits the 1st of February. He did not have last visits. The only person he saw the last couple of days was a minister for a short period. And I don't believe anybody's going to witness. I don't know if his mom is here from San Antonio. I'm with Lee Greenwood, whose son Joseph Nichols was executed in 2007, and Lee came because she's friends with the mom, so I guess we'll go to the hospitality house after and just to see if she is, in fact, in town.
Okay.
But I would be surprised. He made it very clear he didn't want to see anybody.
Glory, would you explain to the audience what it means when the media crosses the road?
Okay, we're standing on a street that separates the prison administration building from the Walls prison where executions are carried out, with the death house. And the media witnesses, as well as the family of the prisoner, are kept in that building and not allowed to cross the street and go into the death house unless there are no more appeals. So just when I was on hold, the media walked in. So that tells us that the Supreme Court denied the appeal and the execution is happening.
How many folks are there, Gloria?
There's a bunch of people here. We brought up a couple of carloads, and there's two people from Norway. There's a young woman here who's a law student at Texas Tech in Lubbock.
Mm-hmm. Richard came up on his motorcycle.
Oh, I don't know who Richard is. Huh? The media just went in. It's happening, Pat. Carl Rodenberg is here from Germany. There's a minister from Huntsville who's here. Several people that I don't even know, plus one biker who was a total jerk recently.
It's probably Richard. I'll ask him about that when you get back.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I thought Pat said he was the one that was harassing us. At another execution, maybe he just looks like another biker.
Yeah.
But there's about 20 of us out here, and
that's a good turnout.
I know it's denied. They went in, huh?
That's a good turnout.
Yeah, it's a good turnout. Ray Jasper was a very special person. I wish I had gotten to know him, but I have friends who know him, and I've actually been reading his writings recently. The stuff that was published on the Gawker website, G-A-W-K-E-R, people should check that out. It's truly amazing writing. And we've got a book of his poetry with us right now called Waiting in the Rain, I believe. And we're getting ready to read some of his poetry over the loud system.
Okay, Gloria.
After I hang up.
Gloria, I'm going to go leave you to read poetry, and we're going to continue with the show. Thank you.
Okay, and I want to send greetings to everybody on death row, particularly those on APOD. We love you.
Thank you. I was up there last week to do a couple of interviews, and the reports I got is the reception seems to be well.
Yes, thank heavens, because for a while nobody could hear.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, and we have another report from a Houston vigil. Uh-oh, we lost him. Is that hello? Anybody there?
Yeah,
Dave?
I'm here.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Where is here?
We are at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd, right outside St. Ian's Catholic Church over here.
There's a lot of traffic there, but there's also construction. Can anybody see you?
Yeah, well, the construction on this corner is no longer here. They moved up the street, I think. So okay. we're clear to have our vigils here before now.
Okay.
And we've got a good turnout today, Ray. We got about 11 people. That's good for us. And we've got Catholic nuns. We've got Quakers. We've got activists, and we have. Your friend and mine, Mike Allen, is here.
Okay.
And with his orange shirt for end mass incarceration. So we've got a really good turnout. And like I said before, this is a really, really busy corner. I mean, cars just streaming by on both streets. And so we have a good turnout. I think Gloria was mentioning Ray Jasper and his writings. It's just amazing. I think there was a prison show maybe 3 weeks or a month ago, and I read some of those answers that he had given to the questions, and it really did reveal a high level of intelligence and a very, very developed human being. And it's so sad that our state will go ahead and execute somebody like that who's truly, no matter what happened earlier in his life, is truly a person that's rehabilitated and has an awful lot to offer to our society in terms of his experience. So it's just sad that we go ahead and execute a person like that.
Dave, why is it that the Houston vigil, why are you folks out there?
Well, we're out here to protest this execution and really to protest all executions that take place in the state of Texas. And we, you know, when we've been out here for on these different corners for, I don't know, 15 years now? I don't know if it's been 20, but at least 15 years. And the good thing about it is the number of people that see us, and then also the number of people that actually come by and give us a thumbs up now or toot their horn, it used to be quite different from this. And I always call it the street corner polling of people's attitudes on the death penalty. And it's really changed in the time that I've been doing it. So I think being out here with our signs and our banners, I think it does have an impact. I wouldn't be here if it didn't. So I think we're doing good work.
Thank you, Dave. How do people get in touch with you and your organization?
The best way is to go to our website, which is tcadp.org.
That is an acronym for the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Correct. Correct.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, you take care.
All right. Jim, what essentially happened in this case?
Well, as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, David Jasper was his father was in the military, and he was born in the Netherlands, and they moved around quite a bit. And he spent most of his time in California. Then as a younger man, they moved to San Antonio, where so many military bases are formed. And I think Larry's going to elaborate on this some, but during that period of time, he apparently didn't fit in too well because the people in San Antonio made fun of him being from California, and he became more and more isolated. And what he started doing is doing rap music. And I don't know if he formed his own band or what, but he was doing rap music, and he was going to a studio that was owned by a 33-year-old Hispanic guy by the name of David Alejandro. And he and David apparently were pretty good friends, and he would go to the studio and record his rap music. And I think David, according from what I've read about it, worked real hard to try to get local artists some airtime and letting them make their CDs and trying to help them. And during this period of time, apparently David had a pretty good studio and had quite a bit of recording equipment. And Jasper decided he was going to rob and kill David to get his recording equipment.
Killing was part of the deal from the
Killing man. Was part of it because he didn't want to leave any witnesses, because if he went in and robbed the studio while David Alejandro was there, he would knew him. They knew each other for 2 or 3 years. So he initially decided to kill him when he was planning to do the robbery. Well, that equipment is pretty heavy, so what he did, he enlisted the help of a couple of friends of his, a guy by the name of Steve Russell and a man by the name of Doug Williams. And they go by the studio on this particular evening, and it's in November the 29th of 1998. And they go by the studio, and they record for about 2 hours. And during this period, after they started recording, Jasper goes up behind Alejandro's at one of the soundboards, grabs him by the hair, pulls his head back, and cuts his throat from ear to ear. And at that point, Doug Williams joins in with a knife, and they stab him like 35 different times and kill him. And then at this point, Jasper puts a sheet. In fact, he even brought a sheet from his house with him to cover the body. He put a sheet over the body, covering the body while they're moving the equipment out. And they started loading the equipment up into a couple of station wagons. And while they did so, an off-duty policeman came by and thought things were suspicious. Ray Jasper runs, they catch him. He ends up later confessing to everything. He gave a confession to the police. He also was living with a woman that he claims is his common-law wife and had told her prior to this particular murder robbery he was planning to do it. So he really told two different people. He told his girlfriend, quote, common-law wife, he's going to do so, and then he tells the police he's going to do so. And the case, far as from the facts, is pretty well cut and dried because you have him at the scene. And what happened, the other two defendants, Doug Williams gets a life sentence, and the kid, well, if he's a kid, Steve Russell, who was there during the time the stabbings went on, did not participate in the stabbings. He gets a 20-year sentence, and Jasper, in turn, gets the death penalty.
The only thing, I used to be in the burglary business myself.
You weren't too good, Ray. You went to the joint.
I know. I wasn't very good at it. Apparently, no better at it than these guys.
Well, he didn't kill anybody.
Yeah, so. I didn't kill anybody. But the whole idea of killing people for a bunch of heavy equipment, is there drugs or something else involved here?
Not that I was aware of. In fact, when you look at, as we're going to discuss later on about his criminal history, there was no evidence he ever used drugs particularly. He just wanted to steal the equipment. And you would have thought if he had been by the studio, been going there for a couple of years, he would have gone there when nobody was there and broken and stolen.
I mean, that's what burglars
do. That's normally
done. You know, the trouble with being a burglar is that you can only work when nobody else is around.
Exactly. And so if he knew that the guy that owned the studio was going to be there, then he said he's going to kill him to keep him having witnesses. He could have done so after hours if he chose to.
Could have called me in. I don't know how to beat the alarm system. That's easy to do. Where are we going from here?
I've asked Larry to look into the punishment part of this case. Because
Larry, I understand that this punishment part of this trial was a rather colorful event.
Well, it was in so many ways. Just a couple of things. One, the Ray Jasper has been found guilty of capital murder. So in the punishment phase, the issue is whether you give him life in prison or give him the death penalty. Now, Jack's going to talk a little bit more about how automatic the death penalty seems to be in Texas, and I'm not going to talk about that. But what the job of the defense at this point is would be to convince the jury not to give him the death penalty. And so the lawyer laid out a decent case of the fact that Ray Jasper would do just fine with a life sentence. Young kid, had
that's the only option. At this point, you've already found him guilty of capital murder. He's got life, and that's basically life 40. Eligible for parole in 40 years or death.
For that time, yes, yes. Yeah. No life without parole then.
No life without parole, life 40 or death.
Right, right. So in order to get the life, the objective is to get some sympathy from the jury and convince them that it wouldn't hurt society to leave him alive. He wouldn't pose a particular threat if he remains in prison for the life sentence. And so the defense laid out a decent case, saying he was a young kid, no real trouble in the past, a fairly smart kid. Dad was away much of his life during his formative years. He respected his father, but his father wasn't there much of his life. When he moved from California to Texas, to San Antonio, he was put into a remedial class, and he felt like, well, I'm a little bit smarter than that. He got a little bit depressed. Kids started picking on him and so forth. And so that caused him, the argument was that we've got a good kid who went astray. But since he's been in jail, he really hasn't been in any trouble. Soft-spoken, very respectful, not a problem. But then Ray Jasper wanted to testify. And he convinced his lawyer, and he has the right to testify. If he wants to, he has the right not to testify. But he can decide whether to testify or not.
His lawyer really can't stop him if he insists on doing that.
The lawyer can do a whole lot, I believe, in dissuading him from testifying. But the court found that the record indicates that trial counsel advised him of his right to testify and that there could be pitfalls in testifying. Well, it's more than just pitfalls. I mean, if you testify, there's a good chance you can really write your own death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But the record reflected that the lawyer insisted that actually Jasper insisted on testifying despite his lawyer's counsel. Now, there's no way for the lawyer to know exactly what he's going to say. But what happened is it's sort of a rule that one thing that you never do is if a jury's just found you guilty of something, don't get up there and say, I didn't do it. Jasper violated that rule. The lawyer gave him the intro of just saying, now, Jasper, there are a lot of things that have gone on. You heard the verdict and so forth. Is there something you want to say to the victim's family, the Alejandro family? And the first thing he says was, I didn't do it. I slit his throat familiarly. I did that. But the stabbing, this man suffered a brutal stabbing. There were 25 stab wounds on him, but I didn't do it. I was just a witness. Russell, the guy who got 20 years, he's the one who did the stabbing. Doug Williams didn't do the stabbing, although he's got a lengthy sentence himself. But he says, I didn't do it. In fact, he says that the victim was one of the nicest people I've ever met. But I was just a witness. I didn't do anything.
But he did admit cutting his throat.
I'm saying, I cut his throat from here, but that didn't kill him. And so he's telling the parents that because the lawyer tries to get him, give him the intro of saying, you can apologize to the parents and let them know I'm sorry for it. He didn't do that. Well, at that point, the lawyer just backed off. And the prosecutor, he's already made the prosecution's case. So the prosecutor didn't even ask him any questions. So now that seemingly that all the harm has been done, so you just should leave it alone. What, for whatever reason, his counsel then, after the defense had rested and the prosecution had rested, the defense counsel got the court to allow him to be recalled to the stand to try to correct the damage that he had done. But for whatever reason, Jasper just made it a whole lot worse. And what he said was that he again, didn't do it. Feel sorry for it happening. It's a terrible thing.
All of this is in the record.
All of this is in the record.
And listeners out here can get the record and read it for themselves.
They can do so.
It's quoted in an appeal somewhere. How did you get your hands on the record?
I just printed it out.
Comes out of the federal writ.
Comes out of the federal writ. Okay.
Okay, but he went so far as to say, he admitted that he planned the robbery and the killing, but he didn't do the killing. And he then denies responsibility. That's the big prosecution argument. He can't even take responsibility for what he did. He then says, I'm not the person responsible because I didn't do it. It was just a thought, not an action. And so the prosecutor then pulls that further out of him. See, explain to me what you mean about that. Then he used an example.
He's a metaphor.
By saying that I could walk, if I've got the thought to walk over to the deputy and take his gun and kill everybody in here, that's the thought. That's not an action. If I actually did it, now that's an action. Those are two different things. By this time, the prosecutor is having fun with him, saying, well, you thought about it then, didn't you? Because you wouldn't just say it if you didn't think about it. Now he has, I'm sure, caused people in the courtroom, including the jurors, whose job it is now to decide, do we leave him in prison for the life sentence, or is this the person who deserves the death penalty? He did not do himself any good, but he insisted on testifying, and it seems as though he just made it bad to begin with, then worse and worse and worse.
Did the girlfriend, the common law wife, testify in this trial?
And I think that's something Susan's going to talk about.
Yes, she testified.
The whole issue of the common law wife. Well, yeah, the girlfriend.
Yeah,
Susan, she did testify. She was called to testify.
Susan, I thought that a spouse was not required to testify against another spouse.
Well, the marital privilege that you're thinking about, a long, long time ago, let's just say if the accused were a male, he could stop his wife from testifying against him and assert the marital privilege that she could not be called to testify against him. However, that nowadays, and it's been changed for quite some time, the privilege belongs to the spouse that's called to testify. So a husband who's on trial cannot stop his wife from testifying.
She can testify with or without his approval.
Right. If she chooses to testify, she can. If she wants to assert the marital privilege, she can. She can refuse to testify against him.
And in this case?
The girlfriend, Christina, did talk to police. But then apparently at trial, she didn't want to testify against him. And the thing is, the evidence of a common law marriage was not satisfactory. In other words, they couldn't prove a common law marriage because the court used the family code definition of a common law marriage, which would either be you have a written declaration of marriage on file or you have an understanding between the man and woman that they're married. They hold themselves out to the public to be married, and they're living together as husband and wife.
And none of that was true.
And apparently the evidence failed to satisfy that second
part.
So
she can be compelled to testify.
Well, she can be called to testify, and then she's called to testify.
In this case, really, to clarify that a bit, he did present four or five witnesses who claimed that they held themselves out as husband and wife.
Okay.
The only problem is he had a bank account and some written documents that referred to him as his girlfriend. And so what he put in writing in different documents contradicted what the defense witnesses said and what courts say over and over again is that the trial judge who hears it determines who to believe, who not to believe. Mm-hmm. And they chose, in this case, the trial judge, after he ruled there's no husband-wife privilege, just chose to believe that the witnesses called by Ray Jasper was not telling the truth because it contradicted what he said on leases to apartments, contradicted bank statements, referred to her as his girlfriend. A girlfriend in writing, but Apparently
his spouse otherwise. Difficult to get.
And
that.
They, because the other people said, you know, they'd introduce him as husband and wife, blah, blah, blah. And the judge chose not to believe that. And what he basically said, you do not have a privilege not to testify, and you can be compelled to testify or go to jail. And so she testified.
Does this come up very often?
It comes up fairly often because very often a wife will try, a girlfriend will often claim a common law marriage. And the big issue in this particular case is whether or not they met the, don't you think so, Susan? Probably the big issue is whether or not they met the definition of a common law marriage.
Yeah, clearly they could not put on satisfactory evidence of a common law marriage. Right. And I imagine it'd be similar to common law marriage in a family court. That, I mean, obviously written documents are going to be important where you list another person as a girlfriend, or you list that person as a spouse.
Well, obviously, in a divorce case, everybody's testifying against everybody else.
Where you normally see that, though, is in probate. When somebody dies, all of a sudden, he's got 10 common law wives.
Okay.
Where you normally see it is during a will contest, mm-hmm. and you'll oftentimes have women coming in and saying, well, I'm part of the estate, but claim to be a common law wife. So this is where it usually happens in probate court.
Does it happen actually very happen in criminal cases?
Not that often. We've only run across, in the last few years, maybe two cases that talked about common law marriages. Most of the time, it doesn't really come up.
Okay.
But you fill out
Larry's
documents.
Got a piece of this.
And I was just saying, even in this case, the witnesses, the defense witnesses who were speaking on in support of the argument of common law marriage, some of them were even inconsistent in referring to wife-to-be or fiancé, even in their testimony. So that didn't help him a whole lot. It was not just the documents. It was even the witnesses who came and testified on his behalf and said they were, held themselves out. But then sometimes the witnesses
would slip up
and say fiancé or wife-to-be.
Okay.
But you fill out, I mean, everybody fills out documents all the time where you're asking married, single, you know, name, date of birth,
address,
married, single. And if you're the one that's filling out single all the time, you know, those are documents that can be used as evidence. So you can't be married for certain purposes and not married for other purposes.
Well, so far this case has been most interesting in the punishment phase and what to do about the sometimes spouse.
And what's more interesting we haven't covered yet, and I don't want to step on Jack's discussion, but they had a hard time finding, like usually in these death penalty cases, they have a whole list of criminal convictions and being pinned several times. And they were so desperate to show future dangerousness, they even introduced evidence he's driving 60-something miles an hour in a 45-mile speed zone. I mean, they were just thinking coming
on his way to or from the case.
Well,
had to be two because he left from the case in a squad car.
I have no earthly idea, but that's what I'm saying. There was very little evidence of a prior criminal history other than the only one, and Susan had pointed this out to me. Shortly before this took place, he got into a scrap with a police officer after, I think, it was a high-speed chase or something. Is that right, Susan?
No, the police officer was investigating burglaries.
And they got into a fight. And what I thought was surprising about that evidence, the police officer had to take it through his gun away during the fight, I suppose, so they wouldn't get shot before he could subdue him. And that was what, Susan, it was a couple of weeks before the killing, wasn't it?
It was a little while before the killing. He appeared to be standing around looking like a lookout on a burglary,
mm-hmm.
and that's when the cop approached him, and apparently it was such a, shall we say, vicious fight that the police officer threw his gun away, which is really surprising.
No, San Antonio cops are liable to do that.
Houston had shot him about 50 times.
Of course, right away, right.
They pulled out all the guns they had.
They don't care whether he's armed or not, but in San Antonio it's a little different. Jack, let's get into this discussion about the death penalty in Texas.
Yeah. In order to get the death penalty in Texas, you have to show future dangerousness, and this comes out in a special issue in a trial. I want to talk about first the structure of how trials are in Texas, and to a certain extent, it's these special issues within that structure that I think causes Texas to have so many death penalty cases and so many folks so many people on death row. In a trial, you have two phases. You have a guilt-innocence phase where the jury decides whether or not you committed the crime, and then If they decide that you are guilty, you move into a second phase, which is the punishment. In a death penalty, in a capital case, where the death penalty is involved, the punishment phase, it necessarily has to be judged, is determined by a jury. So what you effectively have is the same jury that comes out and says, well, we hate you enough to think that you were guilty, is also the same group that says, oh, now that we already know we hate you, we're going to decide what kind of punishment you're going to get. And this kind of a structure really, it's almost as if, you know, very often if a jury already doesn't like you and doesn't like you to the point that they're going to find you guilty, there's a reasonable chance that they're going to find, and there's a reasonable chance that they're going to find you.
Haven't they really been qualified to be able to assess a death penalty?
Sure. First of all, among other questions they're asked is, if the death penalty were available, could you find somebody eligible for the death penalty?
If your answer to that question is no, you ain't there.
That's exactly right, because the law is written in the law in Texas is such that you death penalty is an option, and one of the questions you're going to be asked is, can you follow the law? And if the law permits the death penalty, you as a juror must be able to allow for and assess the death penalty if you decide that's appropriate.
Let me clarify that just a tad bit. When a jury is brought over for a death penalty case, they fill out a questionnaire. And one of the questions they ask in all questions there, do you have a conscientious scruples against the death penalty? And even if they say, yes, I do, that still does not disqualify them unless they say, I can't put those scruples aside and follow the law. And they never ask jurors, could you give the death penalty? What they do basically do when a juror is brought over, they're put on the witness stand and questioned individually, first by the prosecutor, then by the defense. This is what we call voir dire. At least in Texas, that's how we pronounce it, and I'm sure in France they'd do it differently. But what happens when you get the juror on the stand, what they do, they explain the special issues. They say that if you're convinced somebody beyond a reasonable doubt will be a danger in the future, could you answer that question yes, knowing he's going to get the death sentence? Because they explain to the jurors, you're not really giving the death sentence, you're simply asking some questions. And they try to insulate the juror from saying, the jurors don't say, I believe we ought to get killed. They don't say that. And when they pick a jury in a death penalty case, what they generally do, they just simply say, if you find that a person will be a future danger, could you answer that question yes, knowing the judge is going to assess the death penalty based on your answers. That's how they go about that. And they kind of hide that. It's kind of disguised because the juror doesn't really say he's going to die. They just say, I can follow the law and answer the special issues. And that's what makes it kind of creepy. Because
what are the special issues? One of them, future dangerousness.
Well, what they used to have years ago, that whether the act was deliberate, and what was stupid about that special issue, to be found guilty of a crime, you've got to prove it's intentional. Well, the deliberate would be automatic if you find him guilty. Mm-hmm. And see, in this particular case, what Jack and I have discussed about earlier, remember a murder case, a capital murder case, is basically a murder case that's horrible. It's an aggravated case. They have to have aggravating factors. For example, a murder committed during a robbery, a murder committed during a rape, a murder committed during a burglary are some special circumstances that makes it more heinous. So if you're already found guilty of a heinous crime, and the next question you ask, would you be a danger in the future? Well, it seems to me the jury verdict of being guilty of capital murder calls for a yes answer.
I'm going to have to call for a recess because we've got a call from Huntsville. Gloria, are you there? Hello? Push the button.
The media just walked out. There were no witnesses, at least for Ray Jasper. But the media's come out. The execution is over, and Texas has murdered again, damn it. So we've been reading Ray's poetry while they were killing him, and we've got one more that talks about dying that we're going to read, and then we're out of here.
Okay, we'll give our regards to the vigilance.
I will do that, and I just talked to, what's your friend's name?
Richard.
Richard?
Yeah.
Yeah, I made a mistake and called him David, so he's pissed at me.
Okay.
Okay,
we'll talk to you later. Oh, okay. By the way, Gloria, how do people get in touch with you and your organization?
We're on Facebook, Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and abolitionmovement.org. And I do want to say that the 15th annual march will be held in Houston this year, so we're working on that. We're getting endorsers and sponsors and this and that. And hopefully Execution Watch will be a sponsor of the march.
When is the march?
It's the last Saturday in October, the 24th or 5th, I forget.
That'll be after my birthday, and I don't know if I'll be old enough to march, but we'll try to get Execution Watch on board.
But you're always young enough to talk, Ray.
That's true. Thank you, Gloria. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
This is Gloria Rubeck, and she's with a vigil up in Huntsville, holding forth up there. We were in the middle of a discussion of Texas executions. By the way, if you didn't get Gloria's succinct message, Ray Jasper has been killed by the state of Texas a few minutes ago on death row. We've been talking about his case. His case is interesting for a couple of things. One is the punishment phase. He took the stand at his own insistence, apparently against the advice of his attorney, and he made things worse by doing that. And there was some issue about his spouse, which lacked the full recognition to avoid compelled testimony in this case. Those things are important issues. But as we get back to Jack Leo, by the way, Mike has got a lay-in tonight. He's in trial during the day, and we gave him a lay-in so he could stay up on all of that. Mike Gillespie's not with us tonight. So
he's too hyper to lay in, but he's not here, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's working on lay-in is prison lingo. You don't have to go to work.
I knew exactly what you were saying. Mike wouldn't understand that. He's from Brooklyn.
Well, all these guys on death row understand every word.
Yeah, I understand, but Mike certainly would think that lay-in. He wouldn't know what that meant. He's from Brooklyn.
Speaking of that, I want to thank Tommy and the other inmate that I interviewed this week, who I don't want to mispronounce his name.
I couldn't pronounce it either, Ray. So.
Well, it's one of those double L Spanish names.
I understand. Yeah,
yeah, right. And so I want to thank them for the interviews that we got, and we're anguishing over the how to best use that. We are not going to edit in the field that I promised you I would not edit, but you said some other stuff. And we're trying to get that in. So we're going to go back to Jack with this question to kind of kickstart it. Jack, after finding someone guilty, a jury that has been qualified to be able to assess the death penalty is then going to consider the same evidence they've already had and additional stuff. And in this case, the additional stuff was pretty...
The additional stuff was, frankly, Ray Jasper did not do himself any favors.
Does anyone ever do themselves any favor taking the stand in a capital case?
Well, you know, if you came back and said, well, I'm very sorry, yes, I did do it, I'm very remorseful, I'm very sorry, you know, this is not who I want to be, I know how to be a better person, my passions got the better of me or something like that.
But even if you do that, there ain't no guarantees.
No, of course there's no guarantee. I mean, if the jury hates you, and they're going to, but in this case, Ray Jasper came up and said, well, yeah, I know I slit his throat from ear to ear, but I didn't kill him. Yes, I know I planned his murder and robbery, but I didn't kill him.
And the jury has been commissioned to decide who's telling the truth and when.
Sure.
Let me explain something, Ray, if I might, from personal experience, that when, in fact, Larry brought it out. One of the best things you can ever do is ask the question the defense lawyer did. Let me give you an example. I tried a case in which two kids got involved in a gang killing, and my mm-hmm. guy was the killer.
Okay.
And so his father, who was kind of a straight guy, I put him on the stand at punishment, and I asked his father, I said, you see out in the family of the dead young man that your son killed, is there anything you want to say to him? He began to break down and cry And that was very, very emotional because he broke down and cried. And then this presents an argument made to the jury that if you had your choice of your son getting murdered or your son being the murderer, who would you choose?
Ooh.
And see, and people...
You could actually make an argument like that?
Absolutely.
The judge lets you get away with that?
He can't stop you.
Okay.
He can beat a gavel, but you know, he won't stop that. That's a perfectly legitimate argument. And Larry's absolutely right. The gateway was given for him to show some remorse and cry. And what we did in this particular case, the father began to cry and apologize to the family. And that was dramatic because I said to the jury, you know, we got victims on both sides. You want to take his son away too. And we ended up getting a probated sentence on a murder case. And that was primarily, and it was
While you're apologizing, let me apologize to Jose Villegas for not being able to pronounce your name until I was prompted while Jim was talking.
But anyway, that,
thank you, Jose.
Larry's dead right, because it was a beautiful lead-in to do something to mitigate this cutting a guy's throat.
The lawyer set up for that.
He set up for that. And what I did with this particular case, sometimes the lawyers, and I'm not trying to say the lawyer's thinking this, you don't want to rehearse this. You want it to be spontaneous. The father had no earthly idea I was going to ask him that.
Okay.
Had I told him ahead of time, he would have braced up and not cried. But I sprung it on him, and I was...
You did that on purpose.
Absolutely on purpose. And because if I had rehearsed it with him, I didn't go over it with him. And I'm assuming the lawyers might have done the same thing in this case, hoping that he'd have sense enough to pick up on this. Because you can make a powerful argument after that, because you can feed into your argument we talked about is that this is a young man who didn't run astray and he's sorry for what he did. And I think that's why the lawyer did it. I don't understand, once the guy twisted off on the lawyer, why he called him back a second time. That's my only criticism. I mean, at that point, my God.
Well, maybe he could not have done anything worse.
I was about to say that at that point.
It was beyond repair. This is the Hail Mary pass of your life.
But Ray, if you're a poker player, you don't put money in the pot just because you've added money to it. That's my only criticism, because the defendant has the absolute right to testify, but he does not have the right to have the case reopened to start testifying a second time. The lawyer had to request that, and that's the only thing I questioned in this case.
And it didn't help.
Boy, he obviously didn't, because he talked about shooting everybody in the courtroom.
Okay, Jack. And what about these cases where an appellate court says, well, you've got to have a rehearing of the punishment phase?
Well, there doesn't seem like there was any.
Not here. Not in this case.
Mm-hmm.
But there are cases that I read about that you've got to have a rehearing on this punishment phase because of this thing that happened during the punishment phase testimony.
What happens in that case, Ray, in two phases of trial, the error did not occur during the guilt-innocence, so it didn't affect the guilty verdict. It only affected the punishment hearing. Whenever there's an error that occurs at punishment, and usually where you find that is when a lawyer fails to present certain evidence about mitigating evidence that the kid had a bad childhood.
So how do you do that? Do you do that with a whole new jury?
Well, what you do, they reverse it. They reversed the case, and here's what I find real offensive about it. They reversed the case for a new punishment hearing. The state is permitted to represent all of their guilt or innocence evidence to you, because one of the factors a jury can consider in punishment is the nature of the crime. But that knocks out the defenses you might have presented. It's kind of a one-sided argument. And what they will do is they basically retry on a short version all the horror facts that were found at guilt or innocence.
Without the other side
without
having
the other side
at the end point.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so that's a pretty well.
But they've already ruled against you.
That's a stacked deck.
Well, they've already ruled against you on your defenses, so that's a moot point.
Okay.
You know, I'm looking at Ray Jasper, and I'm looking at he's a bit of a cause celeb. I read one of the letters that he wrote. It's about a 4 or 5 page letter.
And it just came out, getting wide publicity right now.
And
you can find it on the internet near you.
Yes,
Facebook for sure.
You know, you read that letter, it's real obvious that he's a highly intelligent person who has taken the time to get the grammar right. And, you know, he's certainly thoughtful. He quotes Thoreau, he quotes Gandhi, he quotes Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
But if you even bother to scratch below the surface...
The anger's there.
It's not just the anger. The facts just don't... Facts and common sense don't seem to apply. You look, you know, he says he didn't kill anybody, mm-hmm. except that he slit David Alejandro's, you know, throat from ear to ear. He didn't kill anybody, but he planned the murder and the robbery. He was the first person who did the first attack. And it just, you kind of have to scratch your head thinking, how does this, you know, how the facts don't fit your explanation? And it seems to me that even in his writing, in the letter that I read, the guy is either, he's either convinced himself that he's innocent, or he's just, he's disconnected from reality. And it makes sense why he did what he, at the end, why he did, if he has convinced himself that he's innocent, yeah, I want to come out and proclaim my innocence, and wrapped up in that, also express my sympathies to the family. But again, this is a guy who, when he testified on his own behalf in punishment,
maybe he's in just complete denial. These things are not going to work. He doesn't realize they're not going to work.
I really think that he convinced himself he's innocent. I you know, it's in his letter. Because you can quote Thoreau and Gandhi and MLK doesn't make you connected to reality.
We've been doing this a while.
I'm sorry?
We've been doing this a while.
Sure.
And then one of the reasons we go up to the row, and you know, to me, the most valuable audience for this show are people on death row. They're listening. They're all listening to it. That's why I had to apologize to Jose Villegas, because I had...
I'd like to make a counterpoint to somebody who, unlike Ray Jasper, Jerry Martin really was sympathetic. Jerry Martin, who was the last person executed last year,
yeah,
there didn't look like there was any violence. He didn't commit any violent crime. That's somebody you can actually, you know, get behind and be sympathetic towards. I'm not sure if Ray Jasper, the jury wasn't sympathetic to him, and I can understand why.
Let me go a different direction on this. Now, I want to talk to both you and Larry about this. What do you do if you're the lawyer and you know in advance that your client, like Ray has said, has ignoring reality and convinced himself he didn't do it and somehow believes that? How do you handle that and keep him from how do you go about keeping him or trying to keep him from testifying?
Because the best suggestion we've had so far is making a chocolate cake out of X-Lax.
That was Jack's idea. But the question is, what do you do as a lawyer when you know in advance your client is in that stage of denial and you know he's going to get up and say something completely, totally idiotic? What do you do as a lawyer to keep him from doing so?
I try to plea bargain him out. I plea bargain him out, because in this case, you've got, you know, if he's in denial, he's going to testify.
Yeah.
He's only going to hurt himself.
Okay, how are you going to convince somebody to take a life sentence?
I don't think you can convince him to take the life sentence. I think the only
if you convince him to take a life sentence prior to his conviction with capital murder, life sentences mean different things.
That's correct. Life sentence could be 40
years. 20, or it could be 20, yeah. 20 years, yeah.
Okay. But to get back to Jim's question, I think there's only really one way you can convince. You have to convince him indirectly to take the life sentence.
We've got a couple other lawyers. Susan, you want a piece of this?
Well, yes. What Jack was saying, Jack was making the point that this person seemed to disconnect his actions from, shall we say, the reality of his actions. I slit his throat, but I don't think I killed him. He had that disconnect, and Jack talked about it quite a bit. But what I was going to say is that psychological profile, in effect, is proving up future dangerousness. Because somebody who's not connecting that if I slit your throat, I don't kill you, most people would think this person is a future danger.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he's
point,
in effect doing.
How do you keep him from taking the stand? What do you do?
Larry?
To keep him
I don't think
the
you
stand?
Can.
I typically, in cases where a person is going to do himself some terrible disservice, try to shock them with a stone cold truth. you are going to die. If you take the witness stand, you're going to die, because what you'll have to do, lay out what they'll have, and he can't do it. That is, you've got to convince the jury. One, you take responsibility. They require you to do that. You express remorse. You have to do that. You have to carry him through that, and then you have to convince him that you have to talk to the jury about how you've changed. You've found Jesus since you've been in jail. You have changed your life since you've been in jail. You've done this, all the positive things you've done. And if they can't rehearse that with you and go through everything with you, then you just let them know that if you take the witness stand, there's a real good chance we might be able to save your life if you don't do it. Now, I'm not always successful. You take them through as much of the evidence that's going to be presented against them, all the gory photos and so forth that's going to happen,
and the cross examination from the prosecutor.
You try to go through what you anticipate the prosecutor's cross examination is going to be. You do that with them as much as you can. I had much less risky case. But I almost got into a fight with a client in the parking lot once because he insisted on testifying, and we never could reach an agreement and he insisted on testifying. It was a little misdemeanor, and he ended up killing himself. Well, he ended up punishing himself for doing that, because he could have had a not guilty had he not testified. But you have to really spend some time with them. I think Ray Jasper was if you talk to him long enough, I think you'd probably see him look at his writing and so forth. He's been a loose cannon for a while. I would think so. I don't know what his lawyer did. But
well, the record shows pretty much what his lawyer did. The lawyer gave him a hell of a setup to go in there and say, you know, I got some remorse for this.
Let me make a suggestion to you. I think, and people keep forgetting this, and lawyers are very much at fault at this, and I talked to Jack about this earlier, the thing to do is find out who his support group is. I don't care how horrible a crime somebody's committed, somebody loves him. Got a mother and loves him, sister somebody. Loves him, daughter. What you do, rather than making that pitch to the defendant, because he's going to deny, you make it to the support group, because you want to be able, you always got to remember, people have dignity, I don't care what they're accused of. And oftentimes they're holding out. They don't want to admit to their family they did it. They don't want to admit to their support group they did it. So the thing to do is to number one, when you first get a case, find out who your client's support group is. Build up some bonding with them, spend some time with them, and listen to them. Susan's very good at that. I'm horrible at being impatient, as Susan will tell you. But Susan listens patiently to whatever. They can talk for an hour, and she will be very sweet about it. Build up a relationship with his support group. And then what you do, rather than going to the defendant and telling the horrible things are going to happen, once they have confidence in you, you explain to that mother, that girlfriend, that wife,
I need your help.
And here's what's going to happen. And America, I was talking to a gal named Mary Kahn today, Jack Lee and I did, and what he did to convince this defendant to plead guilty, they put all the bad facts on red cards, all the good facts on blue cards. And guess what? The red cards are about 10 inches high, and the blue cards were about a half an inch tall. And they said to the family and defendant, if we're going to go through each of these facts, if you think it should be a good fact for you, we'll change stacks. After he just visually saw all the evidence stacked against him, he entered a plea of guilty. But you do that, I think, oftentimes with his support group, and that gets him to save face and let the support group lean on your client.
I want to take this in a little bit different direction, because, I mean, I got privileges around here.
Well, you're older than all of us.
Yeah, older than the rest of you. We've been around here doing this, and we've had a lot of people on here speaking for themselves. The deal with them is that I'm not going to release what they give me in an interview prior to their execution until we broadcast it on the occasion of their execution. And some of those folks have come across reasonably credible people. One you haven't heard is the Pruitt interview, which is a powerful thing that convinced me that I don't think Pruitt did it. I think that he's willing to accept responsibility for it because he's tired of living in an abusive situation like he was in prison. And you've had people come on, as Jack mentioned earlier, that came across credible.
Sure.
And we've had people, we had Lurch, pretty much brought the shovel, right?
That's right. When you got through hearing him talk, thank God he got the death penalty.
Lurch, but Lurch didn't think there was anything wrong with what he did.
I know, but boy.
Is that part of the program working? Do y'all think that's a good part of the program?
Yeah, I think it does help a lot. Gives a flavor for exactly the kinds of people and who is being assessed these kinds of punishment. Yeah, I think it's critical.
Susan?
Okay, what exactly? I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. What do you?
Well,
really
I'm talking about structurally the show. Does that bring something to show we would not otherwise have with?
Oh, I think when you go and talk to people in person, as you have and yeah. Jim and I have, I think it does give you certainly a sense of, shall we say, who they are, and for better or worse, so to speak. And that's why Jerry was somebody that, if you talk to him, and even the facts of his case, that was the one person that you could say, like, he really did not deserve to be executed. And also he had no denial or disconnect like some of these other people do.
Jim?
Here's my thought on that, Ray. If ahead of time you've read all the facts of the case, and I said reading the facts of the case, I'm not talking just about what the state presents, because when you work up a case, we know what the defense has said, we know what the defense lawyers have said, we know what the defendant has said through writ, so we know a good picture of both sides. If it's super obvious, like in this case, if it's super obvious that somebody is guilty of it, if I was doing the interview, I would stay away from that, because you don't want them getting on the air and saying things that this guy said from the stand, because it doesn't make him sympathetic. But if it's one of those cases that's questionable, I would go into the facts of the case. Otherwise, I would avoid the facts of the case like the plague.
I don't even ask facts of the case. But we have run out of time, but I want to express my appreciation to the lawyers that participate. I want to thank our executive director, Elizabeth Stein. I want to thank Doyle for doing the engineering in here. Tell your friends they can get this on the archive early in the morning on kpft.org, or they can get it right away on executionwatch.org. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening.
Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're